Jerry Beans Man. Earth. Level 3. Plant. Jerry, a bean soldier, believes he's the strongest warrior in the world, but his true abilities are still untested. Attack, 1750. Defense, 0.
Bum, bum, bum. Bum, 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 bum. Bum, 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 bum. Oh yeah. Bum, 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 bum. Give it to me.
Ba-da-ba-dum.
Hello, and welcome to The Face Downs, your source for TCG news and all things Yu-Gi-Oh! I'm Lucas.
I'm Ruben.
And I'm Joe.
And I'm holding the microphone in my hand because we got the wrong size stand, so I feel like I'm emceeing. I feel like I'm hosting an event.
You are, and welcome back to another episode of The Face Downs After Dark. Yeah. Welcome to Daylight Savings, everyone. It's 7:12 and pretty much pitch black.
Yeah, you guys ready for After Dark all year?
Yeah.
Yeah, true.
Welcome. We're back. Obviously, we took a wee bit of a break. Luke and I have moved apartments, so had to get everything reset up, re-display every single Yu-Gi-Oh! Mat, pop vinyl, deck box, folder. Don't really know many much of the kitchen, but I think we've got some magnetic touches as well, bulk storage, no furniture, just cards. Yeah.
Yeah, and obviously I've just been plodding away doing the Palmy Hobby League, not a lot else. We've had some decent numbers recently. We've had about 15 players for the last 3 weeks, and all different players as well, which is pretty cool to see.
Anyone showed up?
Yeah, we've had a couple of new players. We had a few that have returned from playing competitively back in 2014, 15. We've had a couple that have, we've had a couple of returning players from even just having their Saturdays back from working Saturdays, I guess. So, it's been good to see.
You know what? I'm actually going to tag on to that. I've had the exact same conversation with some other stores. A lot of people have gone, hey, Daylight Savings, we don't work Saturdays anymore.
Mm.
Yeah. It's like, oh, you just lose a day. You just get an extra day of hobby. You get an extra day of play Yu-Gi-Oh. You know what? Amazing. Any people you're surprised to see returning?
Nah, not really. I think we've heard rumors in Palmy that Huggy potentially could be coming back. So he was the 2006, national champion. So that's pretty exciting. Hopefully we
2006?
See. I think it was 2005 or 2006. I believe 2006.
Number six, not 16.
Yeah, not 16. 2006 with Monarch, wow. And then he went to Worlds and played the same deck. So. Yeah, no, that'd be really
good.
No, I think he top 16 potentially.
And New Zealand's got a bad history of people taking Monarchs to
Monarchs
the Worlds.
Yeah. So, anyway, we put up a post in the New Zealand Yu-Gi-Oh! Facebook page, obviously because we didn't have the podcast last week, and we let you guys sort of decide a topic for us. The thing was, there was a lot of good suggestions, and we couldn't really pick one, so we're kind of just going to go through all the good ones, I suppose, all the ones that can be talked about.
Yeah, if we don't read yours, it was terrible, just letting you guys know. We want to go through them, but we will kind of cover one of them for this episode.
Yeah, which ironically was not commented on. It was in fact couriered to Joe, this idea, and that's not a pun. It legitimately occurred. So thank you so much to everyone who commented and gave us your suggestions. Obviously, we're super thankful for your interaction. And I mean, it's amazing to see this kind of response. There's 15, 16 people?
74 comments. Yeah.
Oh, great. That's at least 15 people.
Yeah.
So I think, what are some standouts from this one? Obviously. Oh, yes. From the top, Joe?
Yeah, from the top. Keza's one was pretty good about archetype psychology. I feel like getting a psychologist on to talk about archetypes and stuff might be. A good thing. It'd be quite funny.
There's no any psychologists.
Anyone who plays Yu-Gi-Oh! Who is a psychologist, you're more than welcome to come on the podcast and we'll discuss that one.
We should go through all the ones that are just kind of quick,
easy to
right?
Easy. Okay, yeah, sure.
Ones that we actually want to turn into episodes. We don't want to spoil.
Steve Maverick, the Keza alt drama. Now, I was around for that. For the first year or so of Steve Maverick showing up on the page, everyone just thought it was Keza's alt. I think it started off as a joke, and the joke kind of stuck. And then like everyone started to actually think maybe it was Kez until Steve randomly showed up at a nationals with his driver's license, taking a picture of himself to prove that he was actually a person. So that one was good. We got James with when are Volcanics going to get support? Good question.
Day 1,141. Sure.
Yeah. Right after Rika, which just got announced today. So I'm sure they're next in line.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Definitely next in line. What else do we have?
Mac and Liam kind of went down the same track of the golden days of New Zealand Yu-Gi-Oh, Christchurch, knife fights, police, and more. We can't really discuss most of that on the podcast, unfortunately. I feel like the
mainly
podcast
because,
potentially could be deleted.
Young, and so you old geezers will probably know about it better than us.
We're petitioning for like all the Yu-Gi-Oh NZ admins to do a Patreon-only podcast. At DM us. Like,
please
spill
DM
all the
us
beans
and let us know, because we will absolutely, we would love a tell-all. And we will censor names.
We'll record it and we'll just sit on it. And then one day we'll like hit the glass and we'll release it and then just like dip out. We'll quit the podcast and just...
Yeah, I'll fly to Eritrea. Yeah. You'll never see me again.
I think...
all of us are going to jail. Even
Liam's...
Prison, honey.
Liam Garrity's comment of who would win out of North Island Aiden or South Island Kez is a great question.
I need to know what that means. I have no
another
idea
Patreon
that
exclusive.
that one would be an exclusive.
UFC style.
Yeah.
Kind of breakdown.
Dino's one was really good. I think we might even be getting Dino on potentially to talk about this one, because there's so much you can talk about with what he said, which is the biggest reasons and misplays people were that people lose games, you know, by doing. There's lots
so
that
many
go
different ways,
and he said that there's so many that come up every event that he sees. So I'll be interested to hear what he has to say about that as well. I'm sure we will be able to put a lot of input.
Reading cards is a pretty good way to lose.
I'm curious as to what his point is on like repeatable misplays, because obviously cards are misplayable, but I'm interested what he means by
it might be like ordering of chain links, forgetting to add at the end phase is a big one that I always see come up. You know, just tiny little misplays.
It's often more like how you approach a hand. I'm sure he'll have words on. You know, it's kind of like you see a hand, and then even he talked about it from his YCS top. He looked back and went like, oh, I just like had the win, but I played my hand out incorrectly. I didn't play around XYZ and I lost.
Yeah.
That I think is probably something getting him on would be fun for, because I'm sure this is something that keeps him up at night.
Another one from Liam Garrity was the pros and cons of playing Yu-Gi-Oh! In NZ to other countries like NA. Most of that would probably come down to numbers. Like, just like number of people, events, accessibility to cards. We have that very, I guess the accessibility to cards in New Zealand is really good compared to like NA. But then like old niche cards are really hard to find here, where they'll be kind of easy because you have TCG player in the, you know, NA region.
Market in EU.
Card like market as well, yeah. So like
larger single sites. I wonder what happened to the one in New Zealand. We'll just never know.
No.
Speaking of which, Ethan Bell, the story of YGO singles. you want to tell that one, Joe?
We're going to have to, that's going to also
we'll skip that one.
Yeah.
We're Patreon. Just
right over that
Patreon,
one.
Patreon. Sure.
What else do we have here?
Why hygiene is important? Well, we don't need to talk about that. It's just important. Yeah. Don't come to an event without having a shower.
You're in the wrong room.
Yeah.
Yeah. Topic of sportsmanship. That one's, I thought, was actually pretty good. You know, maybe it's not because they drew well. Maybe it was because they had actually played better, you know. One that I always see come up is like when people go, oh, if I drew this, I would have won.
It's if like, I draw X, I do Y. Yeah. Oh,
yeah,
my God.
And you didn't draw that, so you shut up. So,
how do you guys feel about table manner? Like,
I think...
Just not on a sidetrack, but...
Like, I have to be honest. I have, in the past, like, I don't do it as much anymore, but like when I'm in a really competitive mood, and I lose in a way where I'm like, I brick or something, I'm really angry. And I'm angry at myself or like my deck more than like my opponent. But I probably come across like really angry and cold towards them. And I do feel bad about it when I reflect upon it. But I feel like overall, as long as you're like polite at the end of a game, even if like, you know, it all kind of depends on how the game was played. If it was played in like a good spirit, both of you like, we're being all right with each other, then it's fine. It's when something comes up in the game that frustrates both players is when you can get some bad sportsmanship going on, and the lines become a bit more fuzzy around that. So,
respecting time, conduct.
I think it's funny because when you're
all the time,
when you're really like deep in the competitive mindset, you're kind of like sitting across from a person going, damn, I really want to kill this person. I got to beat them to destroy them, and kind of manifesting all these kind of negative energies towards them because you want to win, right? You're like, I have to crush this person to get ahead. And then after the game finishes, you kind of sit there and look at them. And you're like, oh, good game. It's like you remember that it's just a game and you're meant to have fun.
Yeah.
And at the moment, sometimes it just feels like the most important thing in the world that you defeat them and that's it.
Yeah, I've definitely had moments where I've been angry after games and like kind of come across very cold. And then like afterwards, like I chill out a bit and then I go up to the opponent and I say, you know, that was a good game, you know. And I tend to like, when the, I guess, adrenaline's quite high and you're in that competitive mindset, it is quite hard sometimes to be like, oh, good game, man. You know, because like you really wanted to win that game and like you're just gutted. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a good skill though. It is actually, like,
I think it is, yeah.
The duelist. 100%. I think a lot of the pros in Magic the Gathering, because they were personalities, have showcased this, that being really, really polite, even when you get sacked, even when you get like totally rocked out of top cut.
Kicked in, yeah.
I watch a lot of Reed Duke. He's like a Magic pro. His table manner is unbelievable. He'll like get sacked by the most insane four cards from his opponent that he just shouldn't have lost to, and he'd be like, good game, man, good game. Like, just,
yeah.
He just moves on. It's like, oh, of course. Like, he's played 1,000 games of Magic.
And I have to admit as well, it's so wholesome, like, even at, like, Hobby League, when you see, like, someone lose, and then they're just like, damn, man, that was cool to watch. Or, you know, like, that was awesome, you know. That it's so cool to, like, see someone across the table appreciate your plays as well. So it's important to do that, too, I think. You're definitely right there.
I think last one here we got here was Ross wanting to discuss the benefits and disadvantages of playing the same deck throughout multiple formats. This is also definitely one we want to touch on, as we all three have done this thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think this is a really fascinating topic, and it can instill the concept of diligence equaling rewards and success. Yeah. You know, like more on the lines of sticking with something and then reaping the benefits of it. You know, it's not a matter of your, you know, flash in the pan, hottest meta ever, and then immediately jumping ship when the next best, when new toys come out, you know.
I mean, there's both sides, because there's definitely been pros that play decks way longer than they should have and continue to top, and everyone kind of then thought of them as like, you know, holy crap, Jeff Jones with Bujan in the mind. Is everyone going like, that deck's trash now, and like, watch me top, still did. But then you have players who every format they're just playing a different deck and win every event with it.
Yeah, well,
they win every event playing a different deck, and you kind of get the impression that experience shaped them. You know, it helped them learn the matchups, better at generically playing Yu-Gi-Oh, even if they don't like master every nuanced aspect of a deck.
One thing I like to touch on that is like the benefit, I guess, is like. The main benefit, obviously, from playing the same deck over multiple formats is, like, you will learn literally every tip and trick that your deck has. You'll learn, like, the ins and outs. You know all the interactions against all the decks, and you can adapt the deck to each format, which is kind of a fun challenge in itself. However, the disadvantage is, like, your deck can just suck in that format, and there's nothing you can do to, like, make it better. Yeah.
I mean, not to spoil the YCS coverage, but I think the deck that won the YCS, can I say it?
Yeah.
Prankids is a deck that is exactly that, where it is an insanely good deck. It's very easy to play. But I think the real difference in skill comes down to your ability to use the average effects of the Prankids. You know, your ability to use Weather Washer in the battle phase, or looping Rocket Rides direct attacks with Mystic Mind. Like, those things that come up after playing the deck for a little bit, I think matter more than just memorizing the linear combo that ends on Butler Pass. It's just one of those decks that you see it as has pilot skill manifest, whereas some decks think more than others don't showcase that. There are some linear combo decks that just legitimately, you know, like FTKs or Triff Pendulums, where it was just like 12 negates or bust. There is no
in between.
Yeah, there's no technical nuance about my effects. They all say negate.
I guess another disadvantage to it is if you then become known for like playing the one deck, like when you come up against that person in the tournament, you can like pretty confidently set up your first turn board knowing what you're going to be coming up against, especially when they've committed to that deck.
You've made it into your opponent.
Yeah, so that's a disadvantage, but I guess the benefit would be, on the flip side of that, you could just take people by surprise by swapping your deck out for one event.
Yeah.
I think I had that, you know, this is definitely on topic more of that, but I mean, I had that. I was playing Striker for like two formats, and everyone's like, oh, yeah, Ruben plays Striker. And I just sat down and played Flu. And everyone's like, oh, new deck.
Yep.
You were playing Go Second Striker too, so people were making you go first.
Yeah.
Which is very fun.
It was like, oh, you play Go Second Striker. I'll make you go first if I win the die roll. And I'm like, oh, great. Summon Robina.
I certainly know fan of the show Capano well enough that I just make him go first now every time, and I'm never punished.
Yeah.
The man's ability to draw Red Ice Fusion is unprecedented.
Who would play a dead card like Dragoon?
him to success.
And then
there's one last couriered option.
Oh, there's actually I got one, but like I got two messages via couriers from two different card shops over the week. Yeah, so like CardSpot NZ. They sent me a package that I bought, and then it had a wee note just saying, PS, love the podcast, and gave me a wee discount code, which is awesome.
Oh,
fabulous. Yeah.
So shout out to CardSpot NZ, which I believe is Ethan. Yes. Yep. And then the other one, I bought another card from Card Merchant Hamilton. And it came with a message on there saying, podcast idea, net decking, good or bad? And then in brackets it says, it's good, by the way. so I think that was Marshall. I'm assuming it was Marshall.
I think, their staff is Marshall Primo.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah, so I think...
Shout out to the Hamilton team.
That one, it was a very, very good question, though. And it applies to, like, a lot of people, because new players always ask me, do I just, like, grab a list that topped and just copy it card for card? And often it's good to do that, to start off with. I don't know what you guys think about net decking, but we'll start the conversation.
Yeah, so this obviously is our topic for the day. We'll be talking about net decking. Personally, it is all I do. All I do. And I think that it is an amazing tool. I'd actually love to obviously speak to somebody else and be like, what are the origins of net decking? Like, where was the first place that you could get a deck list?
Probably forums.
They used to publish it in magazines.
Yeah, magazines. Those two.
It was circulated. I actually have some from when I was a kid. There's like this price guide, old Yu-Gi-Oh cards. And then at the back, it had Shonen Jump Championship deck list. So you used to have to get a physical magazine, or maybe use like early Pojo, I think, would have been the only place. I don't think Upper Deck published that much in terms of coverage.
Not really. I think they had maybe if I think Konami then came in with the blogs later on that had deck lists at the end of events. Mm-hmm. I remember personally Gameplayer like forums 12, for me.
15 years?
Yeah.
I think ever since maybe decks longer. Have existed, you have been able to net deck. I think the internet has been around long enough that the concept of net decking probably dates back to the first ever Worlds.
Yeah.
I even recall watching a video on the first Worlds, which I believe was... No, it wasn't the first Worlds. It was the IOC Worlds that someone played a variant of Chaos that just became like the variant.
The variant,
Chaos Control?
Chaos Hand. Chaos Hand Control, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was kind of a big thing that's just like suddenly everyone at Locals had that exact list card for card with the same side deck that was built to stop Chaos. You know, that kind of stuff was starting to prop up, I think, in the kind of 2005 era of Yu-Gi-Oh.
So, yeah, so 16, 17 years of being able to net deck. To be honest, it's a resource that's there. You should take it. It's a really good way to get a feel for a deck. Obviously, you know, you are a player. The cards do not play themselves. You do not click play and the cards do their job. You are the pilot. But I believe that net decking is a really important tool to help someone grasp the concept or the basics of a strategy.
Yeah. I think as well, it's important to note, like every time I tell someone to like, you know, try out a deck, they generally, you know, find a list online that's pretty decent, has like topped or won an event. And that's why profiles happen, right? Because like people want to show off their decks and like they're literally saying, hey, net deck me, you know, like that's what a profile is for. And yeah, when the players sort of like say to me, oh yeah, should I just play this list, I always say yes, but then I do always follow it up with like, you may want to change some things to like suit your local metas. Like hand traps aren't 100% relevant for each thing, because like you are copying something from an event where like they have done the same thing where they've gone, right, I'm expecting a lot of X deck and I'm putting in Lancia's in the main or something along those lines. So it's always important to like copy the basis of the deck and then like adapt it to yourself for yourself. And I think that's what I would suggest to people who net deck. But then sometimes it's fine to copy card for card because it works.
Yes. As someone who copied Hanko Charles deck list for our OTS championship and substituted a single card, boy, did it work.
Yeah.
I think that realistically, the boom of content creators and the boom of like publicized coverage, like on a greater scale, stuff like Twitch, and you know, this great demand for competitive events. I mean, we saw it even over the first lockdown across 2020, like when the Luxury Championship Series was going on, Pro Play Games, every single one of those events, that is where the world looked to competitive events to get an idea of what to play for the next event.
And I think as well, another reason that I personally do like quite a bit of net decking is a time factor, right? I don't have the time to sit down and lab out a deck and test it heaps and heaps to like work out what optimal ratios and stuff are. Like sometimes I have a little bit of time and I'll do a little bit of it, like, but overall, like I work 5 days a week. I run the hobby league on the Saturday. I don't really have a lot of spare time at the moment. And for me to like sit down and like work out a deck, it does take a long time. Like I know that labbing things is a lot of effort, and I guess it's a credit for that. It's a great resource because there's people out there that do the labbing for you and work out what the optimal ratios are, and it's there to be used. So yeah, but what about you, Lucas? How do you feel on that decking?
I think I'm pretty unique in that I don't recall a time where I've ever just taken a deck that won an event and taken it to an event. I generally am that kind of person that always changes a few of the cards to preference, or just because I think the local meta will change or the meta itself has changed around that list. I also get paranoid that when like a deck wins an event, a very notable event, people start to tech against the cards they were playing. So it's almost worth it to kind of change a few things just so there's something in there that no one's prepared for. Like, oh, maybe the topping deck just didn't play Pancratops. You know, you chuck that in there just so there's like a little unexpected, hey, wait, that wasn't what I was expecting out of this deck.
Yeah.
Moment. And I'll admit that sometimes it's better than others. Certainly the pro players that win things like YCS's know more than me about deck building. I can't say that I can build decks better than them, but I also think Yu-Gi-Oh! Is unique in that I can say I don't net deck, but you could look at my V-dub list and it's like 90% the same as another person's V-dub list, because I think Yu-Gi-Oh! Uniquely has more auto-includes than any other card game. Like, you're not going to play V-dub and not max out on the good V-dub cards. You're not going to play Sky Striker and, you know, play as many good Sky Striker spells. There isn't really much to do a lot of the time besides change like the hand traps, the tech cards, the side cards. And then if you've got a cute idea for like an engine, like I'll put DPE in this one.
Cute idea in DPE, well, in the you same know, sentence.
The thing is, like, there aren't that many cute ideas in Yu-Gi-Oh! Right?
No, you're right.
Yeah.
Most things have been solved, and most of the best things are so much better than the next best thing that it's not worth trying. Whereas my experience watching other card games does feel like taking a list that had just won an event to another event is like a death sentence. Events are won on the back of ever-shifting metagame choices in a realm of cards where one is not necessarily better than the other. And I mean, again, I don't like to get too in the weeds about Magic the Gathering, which is one of my favorite competitive formats. But I was watching PVDDR's tech on Mono Green from his Worlds list, and he was like debating between two mana card that generated mana and another two mana card that generated mana, and there were like 10 reasons he gave for why one was better than the other potentially. Whereas in Yu-Gi-Oh! There's no alternative to Ash Blossom. You don't and ah between Ash and Ogre because they do the same thing marginally different. They're completely different cards.
Yeah.
And I think that is where Yu-Gi-Oh! And net decking, I think, have become more synonymous than other games, in that there isn't much of a reason to change a list ever at all. You can really just rock the same list for a year, Naibo, with V-Dub.
Yeah.
You know, and like, it's still V-Dub. Like, what are you going to do? Take out Lulu? Like, yeah, don't change it. It's still good.
Yeah, realistically, I think where Lucas approaches net decking, and this is obviously being your testing partner, is you see it less as a form of like imitation and more a form of inspiration. You take these lists and go, great, I like what they're doing here. Let's add my own flavor to it. And, you know, it's not necessarily my take is I go, this did well. It's going to keep doing well because there's not a ban list tomorrow.
Yeah.
Mm. So that's where you and I differ in terms of the deck building. I think you're correct in your statement that Yu-Gi-Oh cards, there aren't multiple Yu-Gi-Oh cards that do the same or similar functions. You know, off the top of my head, you can only make comparisons on things like Effect Veiler, Impermanence, Forbidden Chalice, but even then,
yeah,
they are still so different in each of their functionalities that they're not interchangeable in every deck. You know, yeah, a lot of strategies, maybe they don't want traps engraved like a super heavy samurai, so of course you have to play Veiler. Maybe you're a spell-based deck, so Forbidden Chalice is much better for your piece of interaction, or you need to do stuff on your turn.
Is it even those decisions seem to make themselves?
Yeah, they do.
Yes, right. Yeah. It's funny when you think of it that way, but, you know, even the decisions between Imperm and Veiler, there's usually, and maybe this isn't correct, a lot of the time I think we can find cute reasons for cards to be better than each other that might be incorrect. Just because the human brain loves to see pattern kind of recognize its critical thinking.
Mm.
Like, I know a lot of people talk about Veiler and Imperm in decks where you draw cards like Live Twins or Plunder during your opponent's turn, and everyone goes, oh, well, you got to play Veiler over Imperm because what if you draw it off of a Live Twin or draw it off of a Plunder? But then, you know, Imperm is just like a better card. Maybe you are just sacrificing card quality.
Yeah, because you go, maybe I need my combo to start and they plunk down a monster that's an instant negate and destroy.
Yeah.
Veiler's not going to do the job.
Exactly. And in that case, you've kind of let a cute reason of, hey, if I draw it off of my Live Twin, it will be better, cloud your decision making on the actual card quality of Imperm over Veiler.
Yeah. The only situation where I know that Veiler in new, like, for a modern deck coming out is in Despia. Like, people use it light, because it's a light fusion material. So, like, there are legitimate reasons. And I guess.
That's not to say that cute reasons aren't always real reasons.
Yeah.
It's just an interesting point about net decking and card decision in general. Especially with deck profiles, people will kind of talk about, like, oh, yeah, and this was for this and this was for that. And you ask them, like, did it come up? They're like, nah. You know, like, a lot of the time it doesn't actually come up. Things are kind of negligible. And those cute reasons, definitely in Despia, because you literally just need monsters.
Like, it's the same concept as Shadal. It's just I need a light hand trap. Yeah. So perfect.
There are margins for all of these things. And yeah, I guess that's my flavor of deck building, is I like those marginal decisions. I like, and maybe again, this is just me being too cute for Yu-Gi-Oh, but I do love umming and ahhing for a long time over Chalice, over Imperm. You know, what do I side for this matchup, Latzia or Droll? Like, those things do. I love that stuff. It's fun.
Yeah. I think a unique challenge that I set myself recently was, like, I kind of wanted to test my own deck building skills. And I kind of just grabbed, I've been building a Libramancer Punk build, like, just for fun. And what I did is I didn't look online to, like, kind of see what other people were doing as much, because I didn't want to, like, just base my cards off of another profile. I'd built it and then, like, tested and then, like, adjusted. And I know I just recently said that earlier in the podcast, I said I don't have a lot of time, but I kind of just sat there, like, playing Yu-Gi-Oh Pro, like, testing ratios and stuff and, like, building a deck. And I think it's kind of a cool skill to have, is, like, learning why your ratios are the way they are. Like, why are you playing three of this card? Like, if you just take it off of an online build, you're like, I'm playing this three of this card because they played three of this card. But, like, I guess when you deck build yourself and you don't base it completely off of someone else's build, you adapt and learn why you're playing those cards at those ratios, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you look back historically at past formats, you actually see that happen over a longer period of time.
Mm.
And it does totally matter. Like, Fire Fist is a good example. Early lists would play, like, 3 Bear, 2 Gorilla, 3 Dragon, maxing out on these, like, historically kind of average cards. And then as you see the deck progress, they kind of go 3 Bear, 3 Tenki, done. And that's people applying deck building skill and actually sitting down and not just auto-including Gorilla because the other people did, but going, do you need this card, or actually is Bear enough? And I think that kind of logic, you can see it over Yu-Gi-Oh's history, and certainly looking back at this format we're in right now, there'll be discussions like that. You know, people will be like, oh my god, I can't believe people were playing 3 Rite of Aramisia. I mean, no, that card is crazy, but it certainly will be true that some of the decks people are playing now, I think Tenyi Sword Soul is a good example of one that people initially maxed out on certain cards and then started to pull back from, move more into the Tenyi side of the deck, and eventually end up at Pile, which is kind of the final form of the Tenyi stuff deck that Tenyi Sword Soul looks like.
Yeah. I also think, like, a modern example of, like, net decking and, like, you know, ratios and decisions and wanting to give high is currently the Souls package. Like, there's so much discussion about what is the correct amount of Souls to Illusion of Chaos you should be playing, because no one knows.
Like, is it even good?
Like, is it even good? Some people don't really need it to be doing it. Like, what is the reasoning behind it? And I think that's, you know, that's a really good example. That's something that you as a player will have to feel out in your local environment and go, okay, well, I need the body more, or I need the hand fixing more. You know, it's a weird, you know, it's an interesting scenario of how that, you know, how those things can be affected by your face value of looking at a deck profile.
Yeah, and Yu-Gi-Oh! Uniquely is difficult to discern that information from, in my opinion, because you very often use every card in your hand every game. And I think that's another thing that we don't, you know, we kind of have as a luxury as a non-resource-based card game is, you never kind of have that moment where you look at your hand and you go,
can't play this.
Oh, why am I playing this card? I can't cast it, or I can't use it in this situation. Souls is always going to be usable, and it's hard to discern whether or not it was good that you had it or not, because it you summoned it and you used its effect, so it was good, right? But was it better than Retaliating Sea that you could have been playing? Was it better than Nightbeam? Like, you know, there's so many options that it could have been in your hand that all would have done something, and which one is the better one? That kind of stuff, I guess, is what keeps pro players up at night, especially when they bubble at a YCS and they kind of think, oh, man, why wasn't I maining Pancratops? Oh, you know, like, why wasn't I playing MST over Cosmic? You know, those things probably do come up more than we normally think about.
Absolutely. And I think also, like, these large-scale events are basically what most of the people around us will take and interpret as, like, the next best strategy. Things like this YCS Charlotte that's just concluded, 1,170 attendees. You can't tell me that that amount of attendance, the sheer volume of peoples, won't have an impact on what people decide to play going forward, what people anticipate will get hit going forward. You know, these are also things you have to consider in net decking. Is like, okay, what's the longevity on this deck that's just succeeded?
Yeah.
You know, right now we're in this weird limbo of having no idea, and obviously never too early to start banlisted predictions. But, you know, we don't know when the next adjustment will be. Whereas if you looked at maybe an event at the end of June, like mid to end of January, you go, okay, well, this is probably on the way out.
Yeah. This is also the first YCS in years that you can actually net deck. Just because the last ones have been remote, which means it's a different rule set. It's a different format because remote duels generally favor certain types of decks over other types of decks. Yeah, it's kind of fun that this is like the first YCS people are able to properly sit down, net deck, do deck profiles of. I don't know. It feels like it's been a while since there's been this much meat on the bone when it comes to new strategies.
I have to say, like, and I know it's a little bit off topic, but seeing that YCS back in action was so cool. Because, like, over the weekend, like, I know Sunday and today, we had like the Palmy group chat, and like everyone was following along, like watching the stream. People were like, oh, look, this is in the top, that's in the top. Oh, did you see that play? Like, people were just, you know, talking about the tournament again, and it was cool just to have a large scale Yu-Gi-Oh event that people can watch again. People learn heaps from it as well, like just by watching. They're like, oh, that's why people, you know, do that, or that's why people play this, and like they can pick up random things from watching these streams. So yeah, like the streaming side of it is crazy to have like in-person playback. I know the remote duels, they did a lot of coverage too, but I just feel that they were a little bit different.
They were, and also there were just a lot of pro players who opted out. And that's a big part of the meta, is that remote duels were largely won by unknowns, or, you know, a lot of the time won by people who weren't necessarily the favorites to win. And that's because there were players like Jesse Cotton, who's just like, I'm not doing that. I don't want to do remote duels. He was back at the YCS for Charlotte, and he did well. So, you know, goes to show that the good players that left are willing to come back when in-person events happen. Do we want to talk about the YCS much?
Yeah, I mean,
not
we
much
can.
Is out, unfortunately.
We watched it, right?
Yeah, I mean, we watched the end of it. I watched bits and bobs in between work, like in breaks and stuff. Like, we can kind of look at the top cut a little bit and discuss the decks within it. I know that Prank Kids had a huge showing.
Rankers was by far the most represented deck, I think. Yeah,
and it showed.
I'm just putting up the top 82 now. Just the pie chart.
Live research.
There was, I think, 20-something percent prank kids, which was nuts. And also, they were all, like, obviously, the Destiny Adventure prank kids. We'll talk about top eight. There was a two Eldritch decks, one of them pure, the other one the Pyre Eldritch deck.
Cyber Eldritch, yeah.
That's the one. Interestingly enough, we saw a Destiny Despia deck make the top eight. Which is insane, considering there is still the structure deck to come soon. So, I think in the profile, it was Andres Torres, which he has done pretty well with that deck before in regionals. And he describes it very much as a Guardian Chimera control deck with the Super Poly.
Guardian Chimera is nuts, for sure.
It is crazy good.
And you're playing the Frightful stuff just to get that polymerization in Grave. So I think it's untargetable, people... just impossible to out unless you have like a non-targeting removal spell.
And
it doesn't destroy.
I guess a little bit off topic again, but I've been hearing a few people kind of like downplay the structure deck of it, being like, I think it's a bit overhyped, but like, I don't know, like, you know, if the deck's top in a YCS top eight, you know, before it's even got the most broken cards it's gonna get, you know, maybe we are in for a bit
of that, because that's another
whole podcast.
The deck is not overhyped. The deck is misrepresented by the OCG. That's all.
Yeah, I mean, this is another topic entirely, misrepresentation. But I had a very good conversation with an OCG player about like the metrics for a deck's success in either region to be translated over to the other. There's realistically a lot of different factors that go into play with the success or lack thereof of a particular play style and strategy. And I think that Despair is one of those, or branded as a strategy, it's kind of one of those, you know, as someone that kind of falls victim to that. I think that while the OCG is obviously a completely different meta game, the checks and balances that they have are chalk and cheese in comparison to what we have to deal with. I mean, again, my biggest example of this in recent time was at Emancipators. Not a lick of competitive success in Japan. Actually dead on arrival. And in the TCG, it was unparalleled.
Like the strongest deck ever printed. That's not to say that, like, it's not even that good in the OCG as well. They just have a different culture around dueling.
Like, it's still competitive. Obviously, it's best of ones, and like house bans on particularly degenerate strategies are Mystic Mine and Life Equalizer. But realistically, like, the existence of Max C cripples combo.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. I actually have the breakdown real fast here. I'll quickly go through it. So it was 10 Prank Kids Adventure, 5 10 Yi Sword Soul, 4 Fluanderies, 3 Adventure, Cyber's Eldritch Adventure, 3 Rose Dragon Adventure, which is Pile, 2 Pure Eldritch, 1 Dogmetica Invoked, 1 Shadol Dogmetica, 1 Sky Striker Adventure, 1 Pure Dragon Link, and 1 Destiny Despia. So
it's like a usual suspects list. It's like all the good decks from like the last year just showing up.
The only ones I say that weren't around and I didn't see any in the top 32 of it would be Virtual World and Drytron.
Phantom Knights, that was the other.
And Phantom Knights as well, yeah.
Yeah.
Like that
huge representation at the remote to YCSs, nothing in top card.
Literally the fra snub of this event is shattering. And it could be, so a couple of reasons that I think that is for all the case. I think Tri-Brigade has had a couple rough hits. They lost a lot of their power plays that keep them up in the post-Bode format. And I do think a lot of people gravitated towards Prank Kids. A lot of pro players gravitated towards Prank Kids because it is a very bread-and-butter, like, pilot-based deck that isn't exactly easy to misplay and also takes advantage of the Adventure Engine, I think, the strongest of any deck. And therefore, it kind of just looks really good on paper going into a YCS that you can just play this really consistent, easy to pick up and master strategy that rewards player skill over like spreadsheets and intricacy, right? Like the pile deck is really good, but if I was a pro player going into this event, I don't know if I would want to learn the spreadsheet, right? If you haven't been playing Yu-Gi-Oh! Over the remote duel, or you haven't really been like keeping up with competitive events, certainly topping with Despia takes a lot more nuanced knowledge of an archetype because it isn't as broken. Like, Despia is not as strong as Prankins. So, yeah, I think that was a large reason for its representation. And Tenyu Sword Soul as well, just being another bread and butter deck that can go first and go second. Has a lot of good cards. Yeah.
One thing I'd like to mention as well is 18 out of the 32 top decks were on DPE, and 17 out of 32 on Brave or Adventurer.
Yeah. So really, like, the pie chart should just be Brave and
DPE. It's the Venn diagram. It's the three Venn diagram circles of, like, Adventure, DPE, both. Like, and like you said, 17 of the 32 fit in the probably 12 to 13 fit in the both category.
I'd say most decks that were playing DPE were playing Adventure. Like, it seems
not even a question. Yeah. I believe the only deck that wouldn't be playing Adventure would have been, like, some of the Eldritch variants and, like,
Fluanderies,
and then player.
Yeah.
And that's just down to, can your deck not play it? And there aren't many reasons to play a deck that can't play Adventure right now. They have to be doing things that are inherently unfair, or in the case of Eldritch, I think they go under all the other strategies that were underprepared for back row, I think, is like that's the meta call you're making with Eldritch, is that people aren't really going to side heavy for back row in a format full of Omni negates that every deck is playing.
Well, your biggest concern is a continuous spell and an equip spell.
Yeah. Well, it kind of reminds me, Joe, when you were just, like, not playing the Dogmatica stuff in Invoke Shadol.
Yeah.
And everyone said they held their Ash for Nadir Servant. You, like, wasn't playing it. Yeah. It almost feels like people expect Eldritch to be on the pile Adventure stuff. So when you just play pure, everyone's like, "Oh, I took out my Lightning Storms. I thought you were playing negates, but you just set five past. Oh no."
Mm. Yeah. I expected you to go, like, Dagda Verte, and it's just like, "Oh, Eldland set three."
And then I assume the Eldritch deck might have still been playing DPE, because, like, Fusion Destiny is not a very hard include in a trap deck.
But we'll see. List time out fully yet. We only have the top eight list for the Destiny, the Despia heroes.
And the first place list as well, yeah.
Yes. Which was Adventure Prank Kids. Yeah, because it was the two of for kids. That's right. He was on two of for kids, not three.
Thing I'd like to quickly loop back to would be that, like, the preview tree, how I approached that. Like, I net decked pretty much a full Dogmatica, you know, Shadol deck when I first came back to the game. And then I made the meta call before the tournament that I was going to drop Nadir Servant, which seems stupid, and it probably was at the time. But, like, I saw the fact that everyone was on Dragon Link, everyone was on Link Monsters, and I put Phantasme, Drolls, and I think it was, like, Lanciers or something in the main. And, like, it won me a lot of games. Like, as you said, like, so I guess that's where it comes down to with net decking, is how important it is as a tool, but don't 100% rely on it, because people can prepare a little bit towards the decks they see online.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that, you know, this first place list is like a really good indicator of, like, pilot skill, because I do not believe that if you are, you know, your average John Doe and looked at this first place list and went, "Perfect, I'll play this," you will not be able to pilot this. This is not a deck that you'll be able to pilot beyond the Bow Wow Pandemonium pass.
Yeah. I think Prank Kids is easier than Vita, but they're both marginal decks in that utilizing the lesser known effects of the cards is, like, very important.
It is game determinative.
Didn't he win in time because his opponent forgot Weather Washer had an effect? Is that what happened?
Sort of.
I wouldn't know.
Yeah. There was a lot of things that happened in that final.
A lot of discussion points. But I think realistically, that's an example of a deck that, you know, you as someone who is now out of the competitive scene or looking to get back into it, you'll see this as the first place and you'll go, "I can't play this." Mm. Like, complexity wise, that's not an approachable deck. If you saw, like, an Eldritch deck, if you saw the Eldritch deck when you'd be like, "Perfect, this is easy.
Yeah,
I just need to figure out when to use my traps the most efficiently." Whereas I believe, like, if you are not a combo or value oriented, you know, mentality, then you're totally at a disadvantage if you look at it like an Adventure Prank Kids first place list. Mm. I think you should be aware of it. You could also honestly be playing it because it was clearly the most represented deck.
Yeah, I'd say Adventure Prank Kids is a pretty approachable deck because it has a very simple game. It's resolve right and then normal summon a prank. That's essentially the only two things you need to learn how to do.
Yeah.
I think if you wanted to look at decks that were, like, way out there, you'd be looking at the Despia deck and seeing how he piloted it, because
the top four Fluanderies player?
Yeah. Seeing how they piloted those decks that were very much rogue, very much under the radar. Fluanderies definitely was on people's radars, but I think there's still a bit of experimentation left with that deck. Certainly Despy, I think, would come down heavily to pilot skill. There are so many decision trees in that deck that just constantly come up.
The striker player who made top 32, that's a classic example.
And I think these are all pretty approachable decks. Maybe besides the Despia one, just because fusion decks are...
By nature.
Probably the most complicated.
Unless your fusion deck is exactly prank kids, you are chomping your resources. Yeah.
But, you know, for the most part, these decks aren't, like, abysmally complicated.
Yeah.
I didn't watch as much of the coverage, but I'm sure the pilot skill was there.
The one thing I would note with the Prank Kids player who won the event was cited in 3 copies of Super Poly. And, like, I know that, like, I've seen that before in pranks, but, like, he said in the profile, like, he said mirror match. Like, it won him, like, all the mirror matches.
To be honest, having piloted or tested a Destiny Despia version, I absolutely am on the same.
Mm.
Like, it shreds the mirror match. You just completely decimate someone's resource game.
That is a funny thing when you look back at historical lists who won YCSs. It often does come down to they're a good pilot playing a good deck, and then they just had like the one random side deck card that won them every mirror.
They just had that touch of metagame analysis that went, this is going to win the game.
And I mean, going back to that IOC hand control world, or I believe it was either that or it was just original hand control.
Mm.
There was one Japanese player on 3 electrics the side, and a lot of the players there, the American players especially, commented on the fact that they'd never side decked before. They had side decks, but it was just like random garbage they just threw in, and that was one of the first times people remembered seeing someone like tech for a deck, because back then it was all good stuff, right? There wasn't really like multiple decks you had to be worried about.
Like, if you look even going forward, there's like those kind of symbols, things like Starlight Road, when like heaps of back row removal got ticked in, and was like, oh, I can't just activate Heavy Storm or Dark Hole because you can Starlight Road and put out another destruction.
And again, maybe this is just like human pattern recognition looking for cute reasons someone won an event. Like, that Japanese player was also probably really good.
Yes.
But it's also fun to think, like, maybe Electric Snake won him that Worlds. Like, maybe that decision, maybe this player playing Super Poly, that's the reason he won this YCS.
Speaking with Aaron last week, maybe the oppression that he played because no one was on it is the reason that he did so well at that Nationals.
Maybe it was Limit Reverse.
Yeah.
And that's the thing.
You just don't know.
That's where the temptation to not net deck comes from, is because you might actually hit the source. And
you want to become that guy, don't you? Like, you want to be the one that, like,
you want to
first
the buyout.
I want to win, right? Like, I don't care about being like cute about it. I just think there is a legitimate reason to be cute about it. I think there is a lot of historical evidence that to win top cut, you have to be playing something spicy. Not to say that you need to be playing something, like your whole deck needs to be kooky, but having like one or two things that you just on the night thought, that's the money.
Mm.
You still have to make it to top cut, but once you get there, you're going to feel real good about the Necrolord Banshee you put in when there's 4 Fluanda Magic in a row.
I mean, that 3v3, I had one Zeus in my extra deck, so I went, I lose to Zodiac. And so I was like, if I take their Dryden, I get a Zeus with tactics. And Tax was a good card, but it was just like that one thing won me a determinative match.
Yep.
So, and that's the kind of stuff that you'll just think of. And everyone goes, why would you play this? And you go, why not? Because it's right there and available for me.
Yeah. I can think of MBT had a tournament recently where a dinosaur deck was maining Token Collector.
Yes.
That player made it to top cut, and then it was like 4 adventure matches in a row. And it's like, all right, free run to the first place win. Like, just legitimately, I don't have to try. I just main deck the best card for every single one of these matches.
But that's another point of synergy, because in that particular scenario, if you lost will to make a token, that triggers your collector.
And I think that's maybe the secret you go into it, is like, if you're going to play the spice, it has to be generically
good.
You have
to work with you. Yeah.
You can't just play it and then hope you only play adventure matches. But I think Dinosaur acknowledging that they have other ways to use Token Collector pushes it over the edge.
Yeah.
And that's why B-Trooper did well at the YCS, is because he conditionally realized that Retaliating Sea was a good card that you could search, and thought, well, everyone's just going to play DPE Turbo. I'll play the DPE Turbo that searches Retaliating Sea. And it topped him 2 YCSs, so it can't be wrong.
One and one, and topped him the other.
Yeah. Like, that was, I think, one of the most recent examples of a genius deck builder just going over everyone else's heads and coming up with an idea that no one else had thought of.
Yeah.
And then Jesse Cotton in the No Negates tournament, his Megalith Drytron deck was extremely cool.
Yeah. And then the next event, they always you know, you see like 100 of those decks being net decked. Yeah.
There were 2 B troopers in Top Cut at the next Euro YCS.
Mm.
So funny.
But I think realistically, like, net decking is a great tool. And I think it's cool to see these kind of trends pop up and acknowledgement for success. I think if you were the person that got net decked, I think you might, I know I've never, it's never been me, but you might feel a sense of pride. You're like, my creativity or my deck building was so good that other people want to do it.
I think that would be really satisfying. Honestly, that's a small goal.
Yeah. Like, that's probably a small goal for so many Yu-Gi-Oh! Players. You're like, I am so good at this game, or my deck was so good at this event that other people want to imitate it. And imitation is the most sincerest form of flattery.
Mm. And it's so hard in, like, the internet age to be unique. It does feel like
a weird, like, global consciousness thing. Everyone's like, oh, I'm also thinking about that exact same thing.
There's a bit of peacock, like, 10 minutes of fame scenario, like, whenever I come up with a tech. And then someone else tops with it before I can. I'm like, God damn it. Yeah. Now everyone's going to think I copied them, but they copied me. You know, that stuff.
Even though we don't know each other from a bar of soap.
Yeah, but it's tempting just because, like, I don't know. It feels so often in this game that everything's been solved and nothing's new. So it's fun to imagine that you are secretly a genius that is the best Yu-Gi-Oh! Deck builder of all time. No one even putting...
Even like locally, like when Keza puts up everyone's profiles on TCG, oh, sorry, the Your Move TCG, it's pretty cool. Like, I don't know, I quite like when, you know, I did well in the Wellington Regional, having like a first place profile go up on that.
It gives
you a sense of pride, you know. And you know that lots of people will probably look at that build and be like, oh man, this guy's an idiot. But like, at the same time, you also get people going, hey, I like that tech, or like, I want to try that out, and it does give you that sense of pride. So cool. Yeah,
I guess we're closing off the topic of net decking. Just wanted to check in with you guys. How you feeling about Yu-Gi-Oh right now?
Diva, I'm out. I'm just like taking out, like,
I'm out. I'm taking a break.
Collectively out at this moment in time. I've spoken to so many people and it's kind of the same sentiment as being echoed across everyone I speak to. No one really wants to play this format. It's a touch stale. There's not really a lot of innovation going on, or there's no innovation partnered with this like immediate $600 buy-in to basically any deck you want to play.
When we talked about adventure ad nauseum.
Not even that, but like Thorn Dorise. If you want to not play adventure, you basically have to spend $600 on Pots and Riser, and so it's like you're at this like weird limbo of essentially like your engines or your kind of pivotal pieces are at like a higher cost, and as a result, with no larger confirmed events at this moment in time for our local area, it can be really hard to like drive motivation beyond like a regional. I mean, we still want to see people down in Dunedin, obviously. We're super excited to be attending and commentating.
I actually think that there is I've heard a lot of people are going to be attending that regional, and it's going to be a huge event for New Zealand. So I'm really, really looking forward to it. Like, I was speaking to quite a few people tonight about if they were attending. I know that there's like a decent number of players coming from Christchurch. I know that Auckland has a fair few players flying down for it. Palmy, we've got like 5 players coming down. So like, if you're in the Dunedin area, come along, like join in. It's going to be a big event. Greg's really putting in a lot of effort for it. We're going to have a streaming setup where I believe we will be on commentary. Ruben is the head judge on the day. So I really think that is what I'm looking forward to. I'm looking forward to the event as a whole. I'm looking forward to traveling with friends, going down, staying with you guys, obviously, and like playtesting, having the multi-format the day before. You know, I'm still in the mindset of like I'm enjoying being in the Yu-Gi-Oh! Community, but at the moment, the game itself and the format, it kind of sucks.
I think it's time to take a break. I'm like just enjoying other things.
Yeah, and that's
like
fine.
On my Fridays now, I can like go out to bars with my friends that I would normally be going to hobby for, and that's it's nice to do something else sometimes to remember, like
get into Pauper.
Or like other card games or other hobbies, you know, maybe I'll go ballroom dancing. It's like, there's a lot to life. And if it's all Yu-Gi-Oh! All the time, you can get a little pigeonholed.
When
Yu-Gi-Oh! Is kind of bad, you get a bit depressed because you're like, oh, the only thing that I do isn't bringing me joy. And it coincided with, like, I got a new job. We moved house. just that feeling of like, oh, let's try some other stuff, see how it feels. And obviously, I haven't sold all my Yu-Gi-Oh cards. I'm going to start playing Yu-Gi-Oh again for sure. But
I sold my adventure collection.
Yeah, Ruben sold his adventure package.
I've no regrets on that one.
Haven't played it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been just sitting here upgrading rarities and random decks that I enjoy playing.
We've been buying cards.
Yeah.
That never stops.
That never stops, Gal.
Again, I've been buying more Magic cards and secretly really want Standard to be good so I can play it. But, you know, that's neither here.
Play Modern.
No. We'll start a Magic podcast. In fact, this is now a Magic podcast. Well, how do you guys feel about New Capenna, Joe?
Jerry Beans Man.
He's pushed as hell.
Yeah, crazy. I think realistically, though, this is something I always tell people. If you're in like a bit of a lull but still want to enjoy the community, find some nice rarity cards, you know? Mm. I bought a heater. I didn't need it, but it's gorge. And,
rare?
Maximum gold rare. That's what nice. I purchased. Yeah. Perfect.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That brings you a lot of joy.
Yeah. Very, so much joy. And I bought a Starlight.
It's just so shiny.
And I'm very excited because it's nice because you're still involved in the Yu-Gi-Oh community. You're still speaking with people and you're like, oh, I want to try find these. And you make your activity in the community no longer like, I have to beat you. It's like, let's work together and find this out.
I think that's why I turned to build that Libramence punk deck. It was just because I was like, I'm bored of playing Adventure, playing that, playing this. I just wanted to grab something random that no one's really playing with because it, you know, pretty much sucks. But like, and just try to make it good and like try to have a bit of fun with it. And I've enjoyed it, you know.
Yeah, if I were to be playing Yu-Gi-Oh right now, I'd probably build like Punk V-Dub. Yeah. It seems like
I think I'd be
V-Dub.
On the Despair Heroes, like basically.
Yeah.
I'm kind of sick of Flood getting people out of the game, which is a rare occurrence for my sake, considering I own Eldritch and Flaunderies. But, you know, tomato, tomato. Final thoughts? I guess we're just over a week out from the Dunedin event. I'm sure we can cover it on our next podcast. Any predictions for who / what's going to win?
Ooh, that's a hard one.
Because we don't have Albers.
mono green aggro? I don't know.
No, I think...
Timo Pirates?
I think Adventure Pranks are probably still the favorite, and I know
Connor.
We got Dudeson as well.
Oh yeah, Dudeson,
which is pretty good. I think Pile could do well.
Beef with Connor.
It should be like the South Island Prank Kids versus the North Island.
They're kids together.
Yeah, whoever.
Gay dads.
Whoever comes out on top out of those two will then get the unofficial title of New Zealand Prank Cards Champion.
True. That's true.
Because they in individuality dominate the region that they play in with the same deck.
Yep.
Mm.
All right, this is it. It's all coming to a close now.
That's all that matters at Dunedin now. Let's get them on feature table round one.
Yeah. I'll be whispering into Greg's ear, these two players, and go, Greg, like, we featured them for 5 rounds in a row. And I said, yeah, but this is the game. This is the game. I think Adventure Pranks probably. I wouldn't be surprised if we see potentially like a cute DDD build.
Well, again, it's New Zealand. Eldritch. Like Adventure Pranks is probably the best deck. There's like 4 people who play it.
Well,
right? Like, it's not like YCS where there were 200 people playing it.
It's
a very different field, and you know, we don't know what the Adventure Pranks matchup is versus Dinosaur in its current format.
Magic-y.
Versus Orcus in its current format. Decks that they're going to have to compete with in New Zealand that you just wouldn't touch after round 3 at a YCS if you were 3-0. Because after that, it's just all meta all the time. And here, that just never is the case. You'll get to finals, and it's like, oh, what's in finals? It's like, Speedroids? And you're like, Speedroids? Dang. I wasn't prepared for that, and you lose to it because they just have something ridiculous.
I think,
and they draw the best hand ever.
Dragon Link is a relatively good shout as well.
It's a pretty good New Zealand deck, yeah.
Yeah.
Popular. That's the thing. It's really popular here, so
it is, yeah.
Probably will do well.
No, I'm really, really looking forward to...
Hold on to those rocket structure deck cards.
Yeah.
I'm really looking forward to jumping on the commentary for that. It's going to be a great time.
Not Fab. They do Fab and Yu-Gi-Oh streams. Check out Dice Jar Games on YouTube. Dice Jar.
Yeah.
I think Team Dice Jar.
Yeah.
Team Dice Jar.
Check them out before we go down there and see how it looks, because they're good.
I believe as well, there will be even some like interviews potentially before the tournament and in between rounds as well. So there's going to be a real... Greg's putting in the extra effort for the content. So definitely be sure to check out the stream on the day. We will link it closer to the time, of course.
Yes.
Yeah, all right.
And final thoughts. Suckers, Darkwood's getting a structure deck R, so get ready for me to discard your brows. Sell me brows, sell me silvers, sell me snows.
We need them. All right.
My gosh. All right. And as always, thank you so much for listening. Obviously, thank you for sticking us with our little week hiatus while we got our stuff back together. If you are listening along to us on YouTube, please feel free to like, comment, and subscribe and share it with a friend. It helps. Please leave us a review and rating on your preferred podcasting app or method. That also helps tremendously. And we love hearing your questions and suggestions. So if you do have any, please feel free to email us at thefacedowns@gmail.com. That's thefacedowns@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter. They'll be linked in the YouTube description. And as always, thank you so much for listening. I'm Ruben.
I'm Lucas.
And I'm Joe.
And you've been listening to
The Facedowns. After Dark.
After Dark.
That's good.
You made it.
Oh my god, I'm so fucking tired.